only she could slow things down, get a chance to breathe, to think a little more clearly. Brother Stevens had set things into motion too quickly, telling my parents that they needed to act fast or else I might fall into even greater sin while away at college. My mother was letting her hands air dry. She took a deep breath and walked over to the stack of envelopes, sifting through them until she found LIA's. She tore it open and pulled out a glossy brochure, one wet thumb against the freshly shaven jawline of a familiar-looking boy. When she moved her thumb away, the boy's face appeared newly distorted. His colors bled. His neck rippled out, bulging. His nose grew twice in size. But his eyes, they were the same haunting green. "The first thing I noticed was his eyes," she will later tell me, 9 years after my time in LIA. It will take all of those 9 years before either of us will feel confident enough to sift through our memories in search of all that we have chosen to put behind us. It will take all of those 9 years before we can talk about what happened without entering into spirals of blame and self-doubt. She will stare into the surface of the shiny black voice recorder between us and ask to be understood, for her words to be recorded. And I will sit at the other end of the table, hands in my lap, thinking, this is the most uncomfortable it will ever get. I will force myself to hear her side of the story, listen for her voice amid the buzzing of harmful memories I thought I'd buried for good. "His eyes were so sad," she'll say. "They were calling out to me." "Take your time," I'll say. "I wanted to save the boy in that picture. I wanted to save you, but I didn't know how." All those years ago, standing in her kitchen on what should have been a normal afternoon, she had imagined this boy's trapped eyes might be his real eyes, capable of looking outside the red border that framed his portrait. The eyes of his soul, a reverse Dorian Gray, the eyes growing kinder rather than more sinister the longer she looked at them. During the months leading up to LIA, she read the picture of Dorian Gray at my request, after I had first experienced in Wilde's seductive language a justification for the sensitive side I was discovering during my freshman year of college, years before I learned that this book carried weight in the history of LGBT literature. Standing there in her kitchen, she imagined this boy, this reverse Dorian, looking past the whorls of her fingertips, past her standing figure, into a kitchen she had filled with what he might recognize as the familiar relics of a healthy childhood home. A stack of dishes in a white ceramic sink, the open mouth of a Frigidaire dishwasher, the freshly swept expanse of tile abutted by oak molding, the cream-colored carpet of an adjacent family room. She imagined a boy like this one in the brochure, trimmed sideburns falling just above his earlobes, button-down shirt stanchioned by a white crew neck, sensitive curled lashes protecting his eyes from seeing too much of the world at once, would find in this house a sense of peace. There was order here, and cleanliness. There was the scrubbed surface of her hands, the hot water she had left running on her thin fingers until the blood rose to her skin. And what else, she thought, could this boy need? Coming from a home like this one, how had he later come to be trapped inside this red-bordered brochure, surrounded by the portraits of the sin-sick, the spiritually crippled, the chronically addicted? She walked to the kitchen table in the corner of the room. As she passed the sink, a soap bubble erupted on the surface of the topmost plate, one that a second before must have held the trembling reflection of her standing figure in a floral nightgown. "I remember the soap," she will later tell me, eyeing the recorder between us. "A strange thing, but then all of it was strange." "Take your time," I'll say again. "I remember the smallest details." Like a drop of water trickling down her bare freckled arm. Like the afternoon sunlight hitting at just the right angle, a golden glinting streak. She had brushed away the spot of cool wet light from her arm that afternoon. She had smoothed out the pages of the brochure on the surface of the table and sat. Yes, the features were nearly identical, this boy's and mine. She felt dizzy. She could see, as in the endless snaking reflections of two facing mirrors, a different mother peering down at this portrait of a familiar-looking boy. This mother in turn imagining someone like my mother doing the same. All of these mothers asking in polyphony, what else could this boy have needed? She waited for the dizziness to pass. She had felt this before, at moments when someone in church would speak of eternal life, of living forever in heaven without end, when she had felt tired just at the thought of eternity, had waved a hand in the air in front of her face and had said, My mind can't handle this. It's too much. The smallest details. The late morning sun falling across one half of the table. The dust motes spiraling into what looked like columns of sand. Outside the double-hung windows, algae-striped water lapped at the steep shore that divided our property from Lake Thunderbird. During the tourist-heavy summers, my mother would sit on our balcony to watch the speedboats cut V's through the water, daring the waves to come closer. On winter weekdays like this one, however, the lake sat still and quiet, and she kept indoors most of the day. She glanced at the other portraits that staggered, left, right, down the page. One girl resembled her childhood friend Debbie, a skinny brunette who always bunched up her curly hair with a clip when they visited the public pool together to cool their feet in the shallow end and stare at boys. Another, an older man, resembled our previous family doctor, Dr. Keaton, who always made sure to warm the metal diaphragm of his stethoscope before pressing it to my mother's bare back. What are they doing here? She thought. What went wrong? But of course, these weren't the people she knew. The difference resided in their smiles. These trapped faces were smiling in an altogether different way, the corners of their lips stretched beyond the limits of normalcy. Even in her happiest moments, even in her 16th year, when friends and family had turned in their pews to watch her lace-veiled figure float up the aisle to meet my father, she had never seen such smiles before. It was the kind she would come to know as the ex-gay smile. Once she saw it for what it was, this smile would trail her through the next 9 years. She would imagine seeing it almost everywhere, even on the faces of townspeople she met every week, as if the whole world had been carrying these secret ex-gay lives all this time without her knowledge. Turning down a grocery aisle, the wobbly shopping cart steering away from her grip, she would seize up, freezing, hands clenching the plastic handle, the moment she felt this smile sweep over her, as if a gunman had just waved a pistol in her direction. Such was the power this smile would hold over her, over us. She read the words that floated beside these faces. Since coming here, God has shown me a great deal about my selfishness and fear, which I had used to keep myself trapped in a cycle of homosexuality. In my time here, I've learned that I am loved and accepted even though I have been involved in sexual addiction. Being at Love in Action has given me a second chance with my family. All of these faces sang what sounded at once foreign and familiar to her. Foreign because she was unaccustomed to the way Love in Action's institutional jargon could rearrange perception until even the most complex human emotions could be boxed and labeled as selfishness, fear, or addiction. Familiar because the church was designed to be God's extended family, his lost tribe on earth, his chosen number to survive the rapture, with words like love and acceptance digested alongside every yearly dose of unleavened bread, every plastic thimble of grape juice. She slid the brochure away from her. The remainder of the kitchen table was covered with the loose sheets of the Love in Action application form that had been included in the same envelope as the brochure. The top sheet featured Love in Action's logo, an inverted red triangle with a heart-shaped cutout in its center. Even then, I knew the logo was strange, she will later tell me. The heart was cut away, like that was all it took. I've felt this, I'll think, pressing pause on the recorder, playing back a few seconds to see if I've captured all of my mother's sentences. You cut out what was once dear to you. Ignore the ache in the back of your throat. Erase the details you want to forget. Toss the first half of the story in the trash, as my counselors had. I've lost so many friends in the years after LIA, gone without talking to old boyfriends for years just because it came so easy for me to ignore something I'd once felt. I've been so heartless without even trying. The truth is, being heartless came so easy for post-LIA me that I didn't even have to think about it. The trick was to believe that cutting people out of your life was a necessary step in your development. It was like those fields that used to burn for hours in the late fall outside the living room window of my childhood home. The orange wall of fire leaping right up to the edge of the property. Slash and burn to make room for next year's crop. And so I had. Chloe, Brandon, David, my college friends Charles and Dominique, and Caleb, the senior art student who so fascinated me during my freshman year, the first boy I kissed. Let's stop for now, my mother will say, standing up from the table, sliding the recorder in my direction. She will stand in the middle of that field, if that is what it takes for me to notice her pain. Refuse to budge even as the fire draws closer. She will wait for my father to join her. Saturday, June 12th, 2004. It was the gummy bears. Red and yellow and green, coated in plastic. The plastic coated with a film of dust. No one had touched this package in months. I stood frozen in the Conoco aisle, trying to decide between gummy bears and gummy worms, the need sudden and unexpected. My mother was outside waiting in the car, but we weren't in any hurry. We still had 2 hours to go before the ordination ceremony, and it seemed as if we had planned this stop without saying a word to each other, as a sort of way station between the two worlds we now inhabited. Only now that I stared at the candy, it seemed that the simplest decisions had taken on an endless complexity, as if this were a death row meal or some red pill, blue pill moment after which we would never be the same. I wanted to return to the car with the right bag of candy in hand, some surprising choice that would delight my mother, an intuitive leap that would send her voice into upper registers. I haven't thought of those in years! Only I was no longer so sure I knew my mother well enough to surprise her. I left the gummy bears hanging on their metal rod and walked up the aisle. The refrigerated glass to my right so cold it was almost hot. Bright labels flashing in my periphery. Metal cans lit up with pearl-white phosphorescence. The cashier, an older woman with a frizzled white ponytail, acted as sentry, eyeing me from the moment I first walked into the station. I must have looked out of place that morning. Dark blue blazer and white button-down, cuffs barely visible, matching pants, black penny loafers. A college kid headed to Sunday school on a Saturday morning when he should have been vegging out on his couch watching television, maybe even recovering from a hangover. A camera was perched above the woman's head. For a brief, confused moment, I wondered what this footage could later be used to prove. If I died sometime in the near future, or if I was an accessory to some terrible crime, would a police officer later comb through this footage in search of my brief appearance, analyze the look of hesitation on my face for traces of fear or malice? It was silly, not to mention overdramatic, to think such things, but I couldn't help it. I'd just come from 5 mornings in group therapy with suicide cases, with lives that had been wrecked in an instant and never fully recovered, and I had begun to expect the unexpected. A moment of grace or terror, arguably the same thing, could descend without any warning, and now seemed as good a time as any for God to resume his communication with me. Lying about my sexuality in front of hundreds of people while standing beside my father as he took his holy vow, this felt like the lightning rod, the pillar of salt moment, the thing I couldn't turn back from. I headed to the bathroom and locked myself inside the last stall. According to the rules in my handbook, I wasn't even allowed to be in this bathroom by myself. During any trip to public restrooms, you must be accompanied by 2 other clients, one of whom has been a source client for at least 2 months. At once I knew why the counselors had made this rule. I recognized the usual bathroom graffiti, the casual, seductive tone etched into the lacquered stall door. There was a number beside the offer, and a name, Mark. Without really knowing why, I took out my razor and keyed in the number, save the contact under Mark Bathroom. I exited the stall without peeing and straightened my jacket in the mirror. I twisted the dirt-caked faucet knob and cupped my palm under the hot water, used the water to smooth the cowlick at the back of my head. I wanted to make sure nothing looked out of place. At the very least, I could look the part of the good son. I turned off the faucet and listened to the quiet in its wake. In my pocket was a kind of charm against whatever might happen today. A number I could dial. And even if I didn't plan on doing anything with this mysterious mark, the act of dialing would be my secret, something no one else would know. It felt good to have a secret again, to be free of the blonde-haired boy and his palpating hands, almost as good as it would have felt getting my moleskin back and entering the secret world of stories that belonged only to me. Mark's number filled me up, squared my shoulders, and puffed up my chest. Why hadn't I noticed this before? It was telling people the truth that got you in trouble. The previous afternoon at LIA, while working in our addiction workbooks after the mask activity, our group had been offered 2 scenarios to test the intensity of our addiction to gay sex. I had very little personal experience, but I was still expected to repent. The first scenario had been remarkably similar to the one I later found on the gas station's bathroom wall. The two scenarios Cosby presented us were almost comically opposed, and I had to keep from laughing as I read them that afternoon, even as I felt the familiar longing throbbing beneath my open handbook, the blood taking its familiar course to my lap. 1. It is Saturday. You do not have to go to work, but have the whole day free. You know from reading the graffiti on the walls of a local men's room that there will be a man there at 3 o'clock who will sexually service any who comes along. In less than 5 minutes, you can achieve orgasm. You have thought about it all week. Will you choose to be there at 3 o'clock? 2. Again, the same circumstances. It is Saturday, and you are free. A friend you love is coming to town this day, and has asked you to go to the beach with him. He is your very close friend, and you have much to talk over. Will you choose to go to the beach with your friend? You need to be honest with yourself, Cosby said, standing at the front of the classroom with the fingers of both his rough mechanics' hands barely touching, channeling a less zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance. I stared into the gaps between the pads of his fingers, thinking about how people were never really touching even when they thought they were touching, how it was really our electrons doing the touching, a fact that made me feel slightly less guilty about the one major transgression I'd written about in that morning's MI, kissing an art student named Caleb, but also a little sadder about living in a world where one illusion could so stubbornly dictate the way I saw every interaction with the people around me. It was a concept I'd encountered in one of my all-night reading marathons, its words sharp and satisfying as I'd silently mouthed it. Osculation. Two curves touching but not intersecting, never intersecting. From the Latin, osculationem, a kiss. Intimacy as a parlor trick, an illusion. But what was one more illusion when it seemed the whole world operated on so many of them? With each passing day at the facility, it seemed as though becoming straight was simply a matter of good lighting, of ignoring what you didn't want to see. Think about what you'd really do in this situation, Cosby continued. Write down the scenario you'd choose. Take your time. Really think about it. A choose-your-own-adventure story, I'd thought. Only in this situation, the wrong choice could send you invariably to hell. Sitting next to Jay that day, staring through the window his legs made to the carpet, it seemed that either choice would send me directly into the fiery pit. What if this best friend whom you love, and with whom you wanted to experience a beautiful day at the beach, takes off his shirt to reveal the body you've thought about all those years you've spent away from him? What if an innocent day at the beach becomes the beginning of a complicated love story, one you repeat to friends decades later? I could imagine all of this happening with someone like Jay. The two of us sitting in a snug beach cottage on opposite couches, with thick Russian novels propped in our laps to hide our erections, shooting suggestive looks at each other, searching for seashells just before sunrise, collecting them in pouches formed from our t-shirts, the dampness cold against our stomachs, the sand scratching our feet. The addiction workbook made it clear which choice was the right one. The person who choose, sick, to go to the beach may look at his watch around 3 o'clock and fantasize about the sexual encounter, but he knows he has made the right choice. Whereas the person who chose to go to the bathroom may regret his decision, especially if when he arrives at the men's room, the police are there. Exiting the gas station bathroom with the mysterious mark saved in my phone, I half expected the cold slap of handcuffs against my wrists. I half wanted it. At least a trip to the police station would have saved me from lying to so many people. From lying, once again, to myself. I returned to the car empty-handed. If my mother was disappointed, she didn't show it. Her heavily mascaraed eyes were already trained on the pine-studded Ozarks we'd soon be entering. I sank into the seat as my mother started the car. There was a loud ding from the dashboard. "Oh," she said. "We're almost out of gas." We'd meant to stop only for a bathroom break and a snack. Somehow, we'd ignored the gas indicator the whole way. "Think we can make it?" There was a dare in her voice. Could we really make it? Or might we find in our breakdown the best possible excuse not to make it? I ignored the dare. Too obvious. The preacher's son and wife stalled on the side of the road. Some congregant's car passing us on the way to the church, pulling over to save the day. "That was a close call," people would say. "Satan trying to block your path." And my mother and I sitting with the knowledge that we were the Satan in my father's story. That perhaps this was what we'd always been. "The gas is pretty low," I said, already opening the door. "I'll get it." My mother pressed the button for the tank. "You are your father's son." Meaning my father and I didn't take these kinds of risks with cars, having worked at the dealership for so long. Meaning these weren't the risks that mattered to us. But the truth was, I wasn't really like my father in this respect. I had yet to take the kinds of risks he'd taken at my age. At 19, he'd already married my mother and taken over the family cotton gin, changed the entire trajectory his life was to take. Now in his mid-50s, he was about to change everything again. Time was running out for me to turn out like my father. I had yet to make the jump into hetero life, work miracles with my hands, create something stable. I slid the nozzle into the tank, pressed the trigger. I'd always enjoyed the rush of gasoline beneath my palm, the knowledge that such a simple act could propel us such great distances. The myth of progress, of unending supply. I, like my counselors, still clung to it. I read enough articles each day to know that President Bush was continually telling the country how important it was to tap into our own oil reserves, reduce foreign dependency. And why couldn't faith operate the same way? Couldn't God's love come back to me in all its abundance if I just searched in the right places? Couldn't I still be cured if I dug deep enough, went far enough behind the mask to the source of my true hetero self? Or had I already dirtied myself too much by pressing Mark's number into my phone, harboring the enemy in my pocket? "Make me pure," I prayed. Gallons of unleaded gasoline rushing through my fingertips, soon to be converted into something useful. "Please help me to be pure. Please help me to be pure." His son, his wife. For a while, it seemed my mother and I had lost ourselves in the abundance of all that my father had come to represent for the people around us. We couldn't blame him for it, but still, he hadn't done anything to stop it from happening. Perhaps he hadn't even known it was happening. For him, it was natural, and I suppose it was natural for us, too, since the Bible continually advised the lesser members of a family to get behind the head of the household, support the father's belief system. But hadn't there also been times when my father had urged me to become my own person? Hadn't he, of all people, learned the importance of individual character? His father, the drunk, had brought him to God, taught him the importance of the church, all the while beating him and his siblings whenever he got into one of his foul moods. Statistically, my father should have turned out to be the same violent drunk as my grandfather was. Instead, he had rebelled against this childhood trauma and taken on the more radical faith of the fundamentalist. By love and action standards, it should have been my father who turned out gay, not me, since he'd suffered all of the trauma, while my own childhood had been relatively peaceful. By love and action standards, my father's life made no sense. I slid back in the seat, kicked off my loafers, and propped my black-socked feet on the cold vent. My toes instantly submerged in what felt like icy water. A sliver of sun burned the side of my face. "How do you feel?" my mother said. Her hands were firmly fixed at 10-2 on the wheel. This vigilance. This never taking a risk when you didn't have to. "I'm fine." We're all faking it.
"We can stop again if you need."
"That's okay."
"It's just that some of us are more aware of it."
Silence. My big toe toggling the vent open and closed. With Mark's number in my pocket, I suddenly knew that what I was thinking was true. Keeping a secret, telling a lie by omission, made it much easier to see all of the other lies around me. An expert liar wasn't merely an expert on his own lies, but those of others as well. Was this why LIA's counselors were so good at challenging their patients, at calling them out? Was this why Smid and the blonde-haired boy didn't fully trust me?
"Are you hungry?"
"No."
"I can tell all of this to you later, after the ceremony. I just have to wait for the right moment."
"Are you sure? Are you hungry?"
"But I'm afraid you'd be disgusted with me. I'm afraid you'd vomit again, right here in the car."
"A little." The car turned a sharp curve, a stray pen tumbling out of the cup holder and rolling across the floorboard, a ping as it hit the metal bar beneath my feet. I could have picked it up, uncapped its top, and written my confession right then and there, had LIA's rules permitted it.
Let's stop then. I realize this now, that all of it might come down to me being afraid. That all of this supposed change is just to please him. To please you. I'll pull into Sonic. What do you want? Just some fries? But I'm afraid of losing you. I'm afraid of what I'll become if I lose you. I'm afraid because I think I've already lost God. God stopped speaking to me, and what am I supposed to do without him? After 19 years with God's voice buzzing around in my head 24 hours a day, how am I supposed to walk around without his constant assurance? An order of fries, please, and a Coke. Beneath the speaker's static, the clanging of metal in an invisible sink. And a Sonic burger. Can I get tater tots instead? I don't even know what it would look like to be gay. I can't even imagine a life where my friends and family would want to talk to me if I was openly gay. Make that tater tots instead of fries. I'm not really that hungry. I can do this. I just have to fake my way through until I can take my big risk, whatever that will be. You're going to be hungry later, my mother said, pressing the button for the automatic windows, the glass sliding behind her and thudding into rubber insulation. The ceremony's going to take a while, and you're going to be hungry. Let's pray to God we don't have to stay for the reception. The church was just as I remembered it. The sanctuary's walls were bright and eggshell white, with handsome wooden rows spaced evenly to the stage. A white projector screen took up stage center, and behind it stood the bottom of a large wooden dove, backlit with shattered light that Brother Stevens had created, perhaps unconsciously, to mimic the great Roman Catholic artist Gian Lorenzo Bernini's golden flutes of light. This setup was a flaw in the sanctuary's design, covering up the most beautiful object in the room. But Brother Stevens made up for it by requesting that whoever ran the projector flip the button to retract the screen at the end of his sermon, at the exact moment when he began calling for people to walk down the aisle and accept Jesus Christ as their personal savior. Would you do the right thing this morning? Would you follow Jesus where he leads you? The screen buzzing in the quiet auditorium, the dove revealed mid-flight, its wings flame-tipped, its light glistening on the blue baptismal waters below it. Where on a good day, Brother Stevens would baptize a new congregant in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. The slow reveal was breathtaking, and it had often worked, inspiring many people to take the first step out of their pews and approach this holy dove, this one extravagant object in an otherwise bare sanctuary. It would later occur to me that much of the success of the Baptist Church in this part of the country could be attributed to its elegant use of contrast. Unlike the heavily adorned Catholic Church, the Baptist Church sought to dazzle with just one or two displays of beauty, sensing perhaps that most of the congregants, who came from humble backgrounds, would feel overwhelmed by too much ostentation. People like Brother Stevens and my father were proud of the church's austere, Spartan embrace of utility. This plainness lent weight to my father's life story, rising as he had out of a modest family. You could see this sensibility reflected in the way the congregants spoke of worldly possessions, quoting passages on the corruptive influence of money. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, the way they constantly joked about how poor they were, how abject their circumstances had become. It was a badge of honor to stand before the pulpit and reveal a testimonial that featured at least one fall from a great coffer-filled height. These, they believed, were the humble beginnings of Christ's church, barely modernized for today's audiences. These were the circumstances necessary and sufficient for grace, the ramshackle stable planted, as this church was, in the middle of an empty field. A hand on my shoulder, pinching the back of my neck. You must be so excited for your dad. Fingers gripping my elbow, spinning me in the direction of an elderly woman's worry-creased face, large glasses perched on the end of her nose. Do you remember me? A middle-aged man at my side, poking me in the ribs. Read the Da Vinci Code yet? Pretty blasphemous, but it really pokes fun at all those Catholics, all that ugly Mary worshipping. These people gathered here to celebrate my father's life, to usher this new family into the pastorate. These were the same good people I'd loved and trusted all of my life. Still, we're all lying to ourselves, I thought, my hand glued to the phone in my pocket. One quick press of a button and all of this would end. Why are we all still lying to ourselves? It was confusing to slip back into this crowd of people who cared for me and wanted only the best for me. All the while I knew that, had they known what I held in my hand, they would have run straight to Brother Stevens and demanded my father's immediate resignation. Everywhere I turned, another smile behind which I sensed a thousand swirling repressions. Hadn't we all heard the stories, the church rumors? The man who cheated on his wife with a dozen other women, the couple who videotaped a youth group sleepover at their house, the camera discovered by a young girl who spotted the blinking red light between stacks of church literature. Of course, I knew the whole world was filled with such things. The only difference here, in this sanctuary, was that people were trying to become something greater than the sum of their parts. Or really, it was their parts that they were trying to erase. And this new Christ-filled body, this baptized, cleansed, non-corporeal body, had no room, could spare no tolerance for the old ways of living. A trembling hand at the small of my back, Brother Nielsen's wrinkled face staring up at me. Brother Hank at his side, holding the old man's thin elbow to steady him.
Finally back from your fancy college? Did you learn anything there you couldn't learn here?
Not too much, I said. I've learned that your new Kamal philosophy isn't worth a damn. I went in with everything I had, and here I am, still as lost and confused as ever. I gripped Brother Nielsen's weak hand. He'd grown so fragile in the year since I'd last seen him at the dealership that I didn't want to tell him what I really thought. How it must have been so easy for him, a straight man, to live such an outstanding life, and then sit back and watch the fruits of his labor flower before him in the form of younger deacons, younger preachers like my father, whom he'd inspired with his unwavering devotion, his unerring connection to God. How he didn't have any idea what it felt like to be cut off without warning. Please help me to be pure.
Leave the boy alone, Brother Hank said, smiling, his teeth blindingly white.
I'd once heard him brag that he used Crest white strips every night since he'd become a car salesman.
Keeping myself pure, boys, he'd said. The customer can't resist.
It's fine, I said. It's not. A few more people crowded in, shook my hand. I spotted an empty aisle and made my way through it, hoping to move to a less crowded part of the sanctuary. The space was narrow, my knees knocking against the polished wood, and I found myself in the awkward position of turning my back to most of the congregants just to get by. I could feel their eyes on my back, and I wondered once again when the lightning strike would come. Would God wait for the moment when I stood on stage and blatantly lied? Or would he do it in this quiet moment, in this lull before the storm? The space around me was contracting, the lights brighter, blinding.
Where have you been?
A familiar voice. I turned to face a smiling wild thing, his hand already waiting for mine. College, mostly. I shook his hand. I wondered if he somehow knew where I'd been this past week.
Always knew you were smarter than I was, he said.
He seemed even more clean-cut than when I'd last seen him at the county jail. His sideburns perfectly trimmed, and his white shirt starched.
Got your PhD yet?
Not yet. It's easy for you, too, living out your life the way you want until someone like my father comes along and cleans you up. Now you do the same for others. But I've never really lived out my sinful life. I never knew what it was like, so I don't know the first thing about conversion. I'll be right back. Once I got out on the other side, a whole new crowd had formed, waiting and eager to greet me. I could feel the self-pity building behind my fake smile, but I couldn't stop it. My palm felt hot against the razor. I was beginning to draw short of breath.
It's been such a long time, another voice said. Where have you been?
There was that question again, posed by another familiar stranger. I could never remember people's names, a shortcoming that sent a ripple of panic through my chest as the sanctuary began to fill up. My father simply knew too many people, had done too many favors for too many families, and so people knew my name by heart. Prayed for me along with the rest of my family, worried over my future success because I was his son. How many times had my father sat beside someone's hospital bed and prayed for God's healing power? How many times had he attended the funeral of one of his friend's distant relatives, usually a person he hadn't even seen, just to offer some extra emotional support? To most people in the church, the number seemed infinite. I made a beeline to my old perch at the back of the sanctuary. I needed space. I thought my lungs were going to collapse,
The air had disappeared from the room. I walked up the narrow steps leading to the empty booth and sat before the monitor. The projector had already been set up for the ceremony. Happy photos of our family standing next to the foyer's fake plastic plants, all of us beaming for the camera. My father with his hand on the hood of his award-winning 1934 Ford, the one he built himself. My father standing in front of our blue cotton gin, ribbons of cotton plastered to his shirt. "Brother Conley's ordination," the screen read. I highlighted the text and changed it to small caps instead of all caps, a small tweak that always made slides look better. Having something to do calmed me a bit, slowed my breathing. Later, I would come to recognize these symptoms as the first signs of a panic attack. At the time, they felt like the first symptoms of dying.
"Thanks for that."
I turned to face my father for the first time since coming to LIA. He was looking up from the bottommost step, his hand on the booth railing. His smile was genuine, his eyes sparkling.
"Wish me luck."
3 steps between us, but 1,000 syllables between what I wanted to say and what I actually said. "Good luck." When I was born, after my mother and father held me, and just before the nurse took me away to the nursery, my father had used the sharp point of his hunting knife to gently etch a small zigzag in the bottom of my left foot, a tiny scar that would prove I was his, a symbol to ensure that the nurses hadn't mixed me up with some other baby. He was paranoid. He had just witnessed a miracle. He didn't want to lose his son the way he'd lost the other one. After my parents told me this, when I was 8 or 9, I'd scanned my foot for this zigzag, tried to read the faint wrinkles for a sign of his penmanship, though of course it had faded within a few days of my father's etching. It had filled me with pleasure, thinking about this special mark, and though I couldn't read it in the bottom of my foot, I felt it there, the way one feels love in a certain room without necessarily identifying its source. When I first read the Harry Potter books and learned about the lightning bolt scar on Harry's forehead, I thought, of course. Of course love worked that way. Of course it left its mark on the beloved. This secret mark protected you, kept you safe from harm, reminded you of who you were. All it took was the smallest symbol and you were safe. As I grew older and discovered my love for literature, I externalized the markings, wrote them down in my moleskin, kept my notebook close, so much so that when the LIA counselors took away my notebook years later, they took away much of this protection. But they didn't take all of it. The empty pages still carried ghosts. As I made my way to the sanctuary stage to join my mother and father and all of the Baptist Missionary Association members, I thought of this secret mark etched into my foot, imagined it was leading me forward, keeping me protected as I mounted the stage. God's lightning bolt wasn't about to strike. It was already etched into my skin. It seemed one talisman had activated the other. Mark's number taught me that there were secret loves crouched and waiting in the last place you would likely go searching for them. What was Jesus' compassion anyway but some well-crafted graffiti on the corridors of history? An invitation to follow him into the most unlikely places. Love could come to you even in a room that seems drained of it. The projector screen rose. The white dove revealed its fractured Bernini light. And it really was as beautiful as I remembered it. The pastor asked a series of questions about my father's life, about his devotion to the Lord, about what led him to this day. Finally, the pastor spoke a simple declarative sentence into the microphone. "Will you do everything you can to fight against the sin of homosexuality in the church?" And my father's clear, unequivocal answer swept through the congregation. As it happened, I felt something snap inside of me, a warm glow that spread through my limbs. A feeling of love surrounding me, coursing through me. The same feeling I'd experienced when I lay in bed and called on Jesus to enter my body. And I suddenly realized that I never had to take Mark up on his offer. I had already been called. I didn't know if this feeling was from God or my parents or some hidden inner reservoir, but it didn't seem to matter. I knew I still had a long struggle ahead. But I also knew at least one other thing. I wasn't going to erase Mark's number. Let the counselors do what they wished. "Yes," my father said. "I'll do my best." My parents never had any reason to worry about the nurses. In the end, it had been them, not the hospital staff, who had switched my identity. Diagnosis. The movie theater was packed, sold out, as everyone had said it would be. A hush settled over the crowd as the white-haired man made his way up the aisle. The man cleared his throat, stood with his back to the screen, and waited for the hush to settle into silence. For the next 2 hours, this would be the quietest our audience would get. A relentless succession of choked sobbing, coughing, sniffling, and moaning, running like an alternate soundtrack behind the torture sequences that were so vital to the success of 2004's The Passion of the Christ. I sat in the back, between Charles, my new roommate, and Dominique. The twins usually came as a pair, as they had to our college, a singing pair, singing almost everywhere they went. Though here, in this room full of evangelicals, they kept it to a minimum. Just 1 week earlier, the last week of February, I had attended one of their recitals. Watched Dominique march up and down the theater aisle in her floral print muumuu and scarf ensemble and belt out Summertime in a tone that struck me as both garish and beautiful. I had delighted in her exaggerated minstrel expressions, her imitation of how white people thought a black person should look, only because she seemed so self-aware, so politically charged, in a way I could hardly imagine for myself. On scholarship for singing, Charles and Dominique were ostracized, if not intentionally, then at least by default, and it was often hard to tell where one of their performances ended and another began, so uncomfortable were they with the whole setup. They were also struggling along with me in my Comp 2 class, a fact that, given their near-total refusal to open their ranks for anyone else, made it possible for us to become friends, to spend all-nighters in the cramped dorm lounge writing papers, knitting together our growing impressions of the world. "Do you think it'll snow while we're here?" Charles said. We'd been arguing about it for the past week, ever since the meteorologist first mentioned the possibility. This was around the time when I'd first suggested that we watch The Passion together. "You know," I'd said, my voice a practiced monotone, "just to see what it's all about." Though Charles and Dominique weren't very religious, they had also grown up in a Baptist church and were interested in seeing what all the fuss was about. I knew it would be impossible to ignore this movie, that my parents would soon be calling to ask if I'd seen it, and I thought seeing it with Charles and Dominique might give me some perspective, allow me to mock it in some way, decrease the power Christ seemed to hold over my life. If all went according to plan, and LIA accepted my application, I would be attending ex-gay therapy at the beginning of June, only 3 months away. My intro therapy sessions at LIA's neighboring office had suggested to my parents that LIA would be the best path forward. I had visited the therapist a few more times over Christmas break, and he told my mother that I was making progress, that I would be a good fit for the program, though I couldn't really see what had been so positive about our conversations. Most of the time, I'd simply listen to his lectures on sobriety and self-restraint, trying to hide my trembling hands. A few times I had parroted back the therapist's jargon in order to move past any long, uncomfortable silences. He must have interpreted this as humbleness, as a form of repentance. Though my parents hardly ever mentioned LIA these days, they certainly weren't making any of our family's usual summer plans to visit Florida, and their silence on the subject only made my enrollment feel more inevitable. Watching The Passion with Charles and Dominique would either strengthen my ability to cope with whatever I'd soon face in ex-gay therapy, or it would teach me just how much stronger I needed to become in the next few months. "It might be too warm outside," Dominique said, "but I bet there'll be at least a little snow." "Of course it'll snow," I said. I wanted to put an end to the debate. I was tired of the argument, and I half believed that the late-season snow had a greater chance of falling if we closed ourselves off to it, as we had in this auditorium, like the times in my childhood when my mother would drive us to the city to watch one of her romantic comedies, and directly after leaving the auditorium, we'd find a thin blanket of snow waiting for us under the street lamps, the ground newly soft under our soles. The roads snow-capped and treacherous and unsalted, my mother would drive us back up the hill to our house after our weekend movie, laughing the whole time. "Isn't this wild?" she'd say. And it truly had been wild. My father off somewhere in his shop building cars or in the house reading scripture, blissfully unaware that his tiny family was making its journey through the snow. We could do it without him, at least for a few miles. "I think it has to snow," Dominique said, eyeing all of the white-haired people who passed by our side. Their heads swooped past like tiny, unthawed islands of snowdrift. "Preacher hair," my mother used to say, long before my father had accepted God's calling, before his salt and pepper hair began turning to that soft cotton that so reminded us of angels' wings. "It won't stick any," Charles said. "It's too warm."
"Negative, Nancy," Dominique said.
"Don't give me a white girl's name."
"There's no such thing as a white girl's name," Dominique said.
If I closed my eyes, I didn't seem to be in a church crowd at all. I was about to watch a movie with good friends. It was just a normal Friday night. This was exactly what I wanted, what I'd planned for. A secular miracle. My father and his entire mission defrocked before my eyes, openly mocked by these new non-believing friends who didn't give a shit, these friends who could sing their way through any tragedy. None of this awful school year had to matter. Not the extensive therapy sessions I'd attended over Christmas break. Not the slow but steady march into treatment. Not the slice of suburbia I'd recently suspected might hold the key to my future as an ex-gay. Here, I didn't have to think about being gay or straight. I didn't have to worry about upsetting Christ anymore. Instead, I could laugh alongside Charles and Dominique at the spectacle of his death. A catharsis, I'd recently learned in my Western Lit class. The snow would arrive and blanket everything, and we would step out of the theater as new people, made clean and carefree, just as the transcendent church hymns had also promised long ago, washed in the blood of the Lamb. My ex-gay therapy sessions at LIA's neighboring office, begun just after my trip to the jail, felt like part of a different life. Since my mother kept putting off scheduling my doctor's appointment, I hadn't yet visited Dr. Julie to check my testosterone levels for deficiencies, but I already knew, after my first session, that I was diseased, possibly incurable. I never told Charles and Dominique any of this, worried they would think the same about me. All they knew about my background was that I had grown up missionary Baptist and that my father was becoming a preacher. I wanted to keep these two parts of my life separate, a choice that lent a sense of timelessness to my secret life, a sense that I could pretend to be one person, a complex, evolving, educated person, while at the same time I would always remain a hell-bound, diseased sinner. This secret life pressed against my student life at all times, always there in the back of my mind, and the moment my student life began to make any progress, better grades, more friends, I would be reminded once again that there was a world of sinfulness awaiting me, that perhaps it would always be there. In my secret life, I was always at Love in Action. There the air grew colder, and holly wreaths decked every front door of every suburban house I passed on my way to the facility. In my secret life, I found myself thinking of snow as I sat before the thick-browed counselor and watched his lips move with no clear sound attached. Then gradually, his phonemes merged into real words until there was no way to keep from hearing them. I looked away, searched the window for the tiniest flake, the smallest fraction of hope. My parents and I had opened ourselves up to this hope just when I seemed most lost, accustomed as we were to the habits of faith, and this hope shot us through the tight circuitry of the ex-gay industry to the heart of things, to this place. "Do you think you're masking a deeper problem here?" the counselor asked, leaning forward in his chair. He was sitting across from me, staring, waiting. "Do you think all of this gay business is really connected to your relationship with your parents? Wouldn't you say you and your mother are extremely close?" "Oh," I thought, looking into his dark eyes. "So all along love has been on loan. This man has come to collect." So I sat straight up in the padded chair, trembling, nodding, smiling, and I said something like, "Yes, my mother and I were too close, so I craved that close bond in every one of my friendships." And with that first ex-gay utterance, with that strange tongue still vibrating in the air around me, my mother became something less to me. The bond between us grew less magical, less mysterious, bound to the assigned descriptors, to the role she must have been playing in my narrow little production of sin. In my secret life, when I left the office for the second time, glossy brochure in hand, and a next appointment already scheduled a week before Christmas, there was no snow waiting outside to soften my steps. Over the next few months, the snow still didn't arrive. I was told that these things took time. I was told that I needed to be patient. Sitting with my friends in a movie theater several months later, spring well on its way, I felt as though it was long past due. "It has to snow," I said. Charles and Dominique turned to me and smiled.
In that moment, I thought of saying something like, "Yes, you are the family I've never had. Yes, you are surrogates." But this was not my secret life. The counselor wasn't here, not in this place, though he had already patterned his thoughts into the white mass my mind had become. "Where have you taken me?" Charles said, digging into the popcorn bag between us. It was a good question. Here sat white-haired, pale-faced elderly people. Here sat intermittent sprinklings of local church youth groups huddled together in brightly colored bunches, their matching t-shirts lit up beneath the canned lighting like unstrung Christmas lights. A few more white-haired men, most likely deacons, stood with their backs to the burgundy-curtained walls, their pale hands crossed before their flies, the curtains behind them trembling with their slight stirrings. The white-haired man at the front of the theater cleared his throat again, and the crowd grew quiet. "Some of you will have questions after watching this powerful film," he said. "Some of you will feel moved by its message." Charles tossed a piece of popcorn at Dominique. It traveled in an arc in front of my chest, landed on her shoulder. Dominique picked it off as if it were a cockroach, raised one finger to her lips and shushed us. "This is serious," her eyes said, though the glimmer in them suggested the opposite. In only a few months, The Passion had become one of the most popular movies of all time, largely thanks to evangelicals. I hadn't told Charles and Dominique that my father was just like these white-haired men, standing in front of audiences in my hometown and asking people to be saved, that my mother had called to tell me of the large number of people my father was leading to the Lord at every screening. "You wouldn't believe it," my mother had said breathlessly, as she sometimes was, in awe that my father could inspire others, believing, perhaps for the next few weeks, that there might be something truly miraculous about his ministry. "It's a sight. All those people crying, down on their knees." When I left each weekend for home, I didn't tell Charles and Dominique where I was going. We didn't discuss my rapid weight loss or my sudden dip in GPA. The thing that passed between us for concern, the "you're too damn skinny," said all we needed to say. The world outside our tiny circle was a scary place, and it always would be. But the arrogance of youth made these problems seem like a skin you could shed. We were here now, with one another, and everything else was just so much white noise. As winter settled on our campus, frosting the triangular patches of grass between our academic buildings, the three of us spent most of our time together, watching movies in the dorm, one lazy pile of warmth held up against the cold that whistled through our poorly insulated windows. Our limbs splayed everywhere. We became inseparable. Mutual friends used the word creepy to describe the way we folded around one another, finished each other's sentences, walked to the cafeteria only when all three of us were hungry, our appetites surprisingly in sync. We hardly ever spoke of our families, who nevertheless would have been suspicious of one another, my parents never having set foot anywhere even remotely similar to their side of town. But we didn't feel the need for such things in order to be close. We were here, together, sheltering under the slats of the bunk, the glow of the screen. "We'll be available for counseling after the showing," the white-haired man continued, pointing to the men along either aisle, his fingers tracing invisible lines, a kind of flight attendant preparing for our ascension. "Jesus can wash away all of your sins, make your garments spotless. He'll help you walk away tonight with a clean heart." I lowered my gaze to where my feet plugged into a darkness I wanted to slink down inside until the movie was over. I kept my head down. Charles, Dominique, and I could ignore almost anything. Once, after walking into a JCPenney to buy Charles a new pair of jeans, we were all but asked to leave, the white staff shooting us angry looks, staring us down, trailing us through circular blossoms of brightly colored dress shirts. "Why are you here with them?" their eyes seemed to say. We left in a hurry, hardly talking on the drive back to campus, and when we got back to the room, we drank half a bottle of whiskey and watched one of the three idiot fraternities on campus recite its idiot creed on the idiot quad. "You're too damn skinny. Drink up." In my secret life, the counselor turned to me and said, "Can you tell me a little about your first sexual experience? The very first one?" The question wasn't as shocking as it could have been, given the circumstances. Still, I couldn't help but feel as though this man was overstepping his boundaries. Bullshit, I thought at first. This is therapy. I'm not a person who needs therapy. I'm not a person who needs to tell my sexual fantasies to other people in order to feel better. Besides, this man was a marriage counselor. Someone whose job description didn't seem to provide the ex-gay cure I needed. But as the man began to ask more questions about my fantasies, as he continued to nod and suggest that I reveal more about my interests, my dreams, my porn habits, I began to settle in for the long haul. He didn't want to know all of this for personal reasons. He was a professional, a disinterested professional. I could see this in the way he nodded his head so casually. I could see this in the way his brows knitted with concern. Real concern. I guess my first time was with Brad, I said. And who is Brad? He was on all the sports teams in junior high. Were you on any teams? I waited a moment. There seemed to be an implication in this. No, but I did take Taekwondo for several years. Tell me what happened with Brad, the counselor said. In non-explicit detail. In non-explicit detail? Well, Brad was a close friend before it happened. I was staying over at his house, as I usually did on the weekends, and I remember Brad's house was being remodeled. It was already a beautiful house, a really big house with two stories. What happened in the house? Well, there was a part of the house that wasn't finished, and we went in there to get an idea of how it would look. His parents weren't home at the time, I think. We climbed the wooden stairs up to this loft, and Brad got this look in his eyes, and we pushed past the plastic sheet and headed into the loft, and we both sort of, well, we both knew, mutual masturbation. I couldn't believe he'd said the word. It felt like a cold slap. The way he said it was clinical, but there seemed to be a slight hint of disgust somewhere behind the words. Yes. I looked out the window to the empty plot of land opposite the facility, and though there was no snow, and there was probably never going to be any snow this season, I could see that now. I remembered how my grandmother used to dance with me down the length of her long shag carpet hallway, reciting faux Native American chants, her wrinkled hand covering and uncovering her mouth. How the week after all that chanting, it wouldn't stop snowing. How, in fact, this had been the biggest snow either of us had ever seen, so that now I could see how there might be some truth to that absurd magic of faith. The power of the mustard seed, the smallest snowflake. This is how therapy continued. Try not to think of this as therapy, the counselor said. We're just having a chat. And with the addition of only a few words, dependence, self-loathing, masking, selfishness, the story of my childhood and my developing sexuality took on new colors, new associations. Beneath my shame, the counselor suggested, a hidden ecosystem had been growing. It was my responsibility to put an end to it. Peer just beneath the surface, and I'd find the whole writhing, unconscious mess. Earthworms, I thought, basking on the surface of the wet soil. They weren't there before the rain, and now they suddenly are. Have you filled out your application? He asked. Not yet, I said. Let's get on that. I don't think there's any time to waste. He leaned back in his chair, plastic casters creaking. My gaze dropped to the wooden arm of the chair, to the swirl of its grain. It was a slice of some dead tree's years, all those wet and dry seasons stacked side by side. The tree had no idea, when the axe fell against its bark, that I would make use of those years. The cat of nine tails was striking Jim Caviezel's exposed and bloodied back. Again and again, leather met skin. This is some bullshit, Charles whispered.
Don't say that, Dominique said, her tone full of mock concern. That's Jesus.
That is not Jesus.
How do you know? Dominique said. Do you have holy visions? Does he visit you in your sleep?
I study history, anthropology, whatever. Jesus was blacker than that.
You study music.
Among other things. I looked around to see if people were listening. A woman to my right was clutching her purse to her chest, jumping with each on-screen laceration, her eyes wet. People farther down the row were already on the edges of their seats, as if they had no idea what was about to happen next. This was the magic of Mel Gibson's directing.
drawing so much suspense from such a familiar story like the gospel. Each time the cat o' nine tails landed, I half expected Jesus to just die already, though I knew that that wouldn't be the case.